Certain things you read about aren't mysteries, like Tim Tebow not winning the Heisman Trophy or coming in as poorly as he did in the list of the top five candidates for the Heisman Trophy. That's, as much as he's had this remarkable year, and he's an amazing athlete, and he put up incredible numbers and might have won any other year, it's not a mystery after that crying incident. I swear to crying because you lose. It's going to hurt you in the Heisman Trophy voting. I think it hurt him a lot last week. And, of course, there's some terrific talent out there, too. So congratulations to Mark Ingram and all the people that were nominated, including Tim Tebow. He's got a lot to be proud of, except for that whole crying thing. But anyway, and I'm all about guys crying. I cry all the time. I cry at, like, Kodak commercials, but not because I lose. Won't cry because I lose. So tonight's going to be a total winner, so I won't be crying tonight. You won't catch me crying after the show. Like I said, some things are not a mystery, and other things remain mysterious. And this town called the Dog Town would fall into the latter category. The subtitle is Death and Enchantment in a New England Ghost Town. And the enchantment is not necessarily of the positive kind. It's not of the fairy princess type. It's not on the I get to go to the ball kind of enchantment. It's a scarier, darker kind of enchantment. Is it possible that geographical areas can be cursed? But for some reason, nothing good can grow in certain towns or in the soil of just a limited place, like some place like Dogtown. I've been researching this for a long time. There are many different places around the United States that are considered to be cursed ghost towns that not only went belly up financially, but along with it, found that a lot of people that had been in the town went belly up as well. Mysterious deaths, just a kind of madness that it seems indigenous to the area. And that is the story of Dogtown. That madness is what we'll be talking about coming up next hour, this hour, and we'll get to it right away. Keith Melton is back. Love this guy. I don't know if he's the official. I think he's the unofficial CIA historian. But he might as well be the official one. And there's a new book out, which had been previously classified, a book that's a reproduction of the field manual for agents during the Cold War, the official CIA manual of trickery and deception. And we'll also talk with Keith Melton about a couple of topics that came up during last week's show. We'll pick up that conversation starting next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I had some blogging earlier. I linked it up at coasttocoastam.com. So if you're going to go to the website tonight and click on to any of the links to any of the guests or find out more about how you can sign up for the After Dark newsletter, for example, then if you go to coasttocoastam.com, you can see the blog link there. And I blogged about the supposed, and I put that in quotes and heavy underlining and italics, photograph of Bigfoot. If you've seen that at our webpage at coasttocoastam.com, you've seen the latest in the supposed photographic evidence of the existence of Bigfoot. I'm all about cryptozoological creatures, and I would love to think that this would be worthy of a call to Dr. Jeff Meldrum at Idaho State University, one of my favorite guests ever on Coast to Coast, for his expertise on this particular subject. However, it's so far from looking even the least bit real that I blogged about it. If you want to go read about it, go take a look online at coasttocoastam.com. You'll see the picture of the supposed Bigfoot sighting and then my blog that goes along with it. And that is something that's worthy of looking at if you want to get the local look and feel on the Bigfoot story here from the upper Midwest, just about 200 miles from where I'm sitting right now. Coming up next hour, several, 100 miles away from where I am, is this story of Dogtown, death and enchantment in a New England ghost town. Fascinating. Is it possible that ground can be cursed and that nothing good can come from it, or at least can it drive people to a kind of madness? And we'll get to that next hour with the author, Alyssa East. Keith Melton is back. He's got a new book out that, Well, it would be fair to say that if it's not something you wrote entirely, obviously, it's the official CIA manual of trickery and deception, and it's a reprint of something which was supposedly had been destroyed years ago. Isn't that right, Keith?
Ian, good evening. It was a remarkable point in history in which the CIA commissioned two manuals, and at their core was America's most famous magician at that point, John Mulholland, wrote manuals of sleight of hand. And their purpose was, how can you teach the skills of magic and bring them to bear in the challenges that intelligence officers find when they're doing clandestine work in the field?
And the thought was that these had been mostly shredded or burned.
Well, it was believed. The program was one of the highest secrets that we had in the 1950s, and by 1973, it was believed that all copies had disappeared, and it became the manuals became somewhat of legends, almost mythical status. There were references to them; people had heard of them, but even official histories inside the CIA, no one had an existing copy of the manuals.
And as so often happens with myths, they end up getting sort of inflated, or their prowess ends up being sort of reimagined. When the last existing copy of the CIA manual of trickery and deception was discovered, did it live up to its billing?
It certainly did to me. It was a part of our history that had really passed unnoticed. If you think about the principles of magic, the craft of magic, the trade craft, there are enormous similarities between that of espionage and that of magic. But probably the great secret was that the CIA, beginning in the 50s, would begin to use these and to look at clandestine operations in some way very similar to the way a magician manages a stage.
All right. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you could learn from the techniques.
No, I'm going to get back to that. And I think there's some very compelling examples, which I'll leave up to you to explain. But I want to pick up something that we started last week, though, too. We were talking about this new book called Family of Secrets, which is by Russ Baker. And it's the story of George Herbert Walker Bush, and then also later George W. Bush. And what was interesting about it was he talked about the CIA being a part of George Herbert Walker Bush's life much earlier than was publicly acknowledged when he came in as director of the CIA in 1976. And you, Keith Melton, are you the official or are you the unofficial historian of the CIA?
No, I'm certainly not the official historian, because there's a very fine group of history experts that work within the CIA. I've had the privilege of writing about their work, and of course my specialty is the craft, the techniques.
Oh, love it. And I love your books on especially the technology of the CIA and those wonderful picture books about all the spy craft stuff. It's a blast.
Well, thank you.
Always been an admirer of your work. But what was interesting about it was, and I just wanted to get your impression of it, was this memo that had been declassified, which said that George Bush had been debriefed after the assassination of JFK, and it said in this CIA, in the Secret Service memo, it said George Bush, CIA, was in Dallas, and we briefed him after the assassination. And it was what was particularly interesting was how certain authors had tried to track down this information, saying, but wait, I thought George Herbert Walker Bush didn't become an agent, so to speak, didn't become CIA until he became head of the CIA in 1976. And it sort of began this discussion about whether the company that he was running at the time was a CIA-fronted organization, Zapata Oil, Zapata Offshore, that these were non-really functioning companies that, seemed to be more about putting offices all over the world and having people man them than it was actually turning a profit. And I was just curious, what, how does that hit you? Knowing what you know about the CIA, does that have the ring of truth to it?
It sounds a bit far-fetched. President Bush, the 43rd president, is a highly respected former director. I have never heard those rumors, so this is first on your show.
Really? Very interesting. You might enjoy taking a look at that. In light of how many, you know, because he comes out of Yale and Skull and Bones, and that is sort of the traditional cauldron, isn't it, for great CIA legends, is the Skull and Bones group at Yale?
Well, it certainly was, but if you look back, it's that during World War II, and the precursor to CIA was the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, during World War II. And, you know, people used to joke and say OSS stood for Oh So Social, and it had the legendary connection with the Ivy League schools. But there was really a much more practical reason, and that's that if you're starting from nothing and wanting to develop an intelligence service in 1942, following the debacle in December of 41 at Pearl Harbor, you would likely go to places that people had traveled and had experience in languages and had contacts overseas, and that turned out to frequently be the wealthy elite that went to the best universities and had families with connections abroad. And so if you look at the OSS, there was clearly this linkage. One of the great challenges in the Cold War was that the World War II model, how to fight a clandestine war on that model, was proved inappropriate and unsuccessful, especially very early in the Cold War.
What about CIA front organizations? What is officially true about those? Any idea?
Well, it's all intelligence services, or most intelligence services, sometimes find it's necessary to use companies just for various reasons to separate, put a little wall of separation between an intelligence service and a government. But it could be something as simple as you want to provide ambulances to a country but don't want to make it appear that there's any official connection. It's usually used most often where we hear that there are foreign intelligence services, and specifically the Chinese service, that want to purchase U.S. technology illicitly. And
right.
Do it by setting up notional companies or front companies throughout the U.S., and they buy banned technology, and then they use the front companies to evade the U.S. export controls. So that is a significant threat to us, and one that's looming. And, you know, at this point, Chinese espionage in the United States is the number one foreign counterintelligence threat we face in the country.
You know, historically, there have been companies, American companies, that seemed very CIA friendly, and I don't mean that in a negative way. That just they thought that was their patriotic duty to kind of open up a back door for the CIA whenever they needed it. One of those, surprisingly, I was reading about was the Washington Post and a variety of newspapers like the New York Times, which took a certain amount of pride in its availability to the CIA, that it would be willing to run a false story or to participate in some sort of disinformation campaign, and that once they established that story, that other newspapers around the country would follow their lead. Have you come across that, Keith Melton, in your years of studying the CIA?
Of course, disinformation is well known. If we go back into history, you look at a point, especially in the 1950s and 1960s, that the United States believed, and of course President Eisenhower and President Kennedy, we believed that clandestine activities, be it disinformation, be it covert activities, we believed we could change the course of the world by removing governments and overthrowing governments in a very active, aggressive approach to foreign policy. Now, ultimately, that proved unsuccessful, and certainly Fidel Castro is a classic example who's still in power. So in the 50s and 60s, almost anything seemed possible. Ultimately, those activities proved unsuccessful, and we've come a long way since then.
And you'll pardon me for saying this, but that sounds like that's a kind of a diplomatic answer. And I don't blame you, and I appreciate your position. But at the same time, can we not confirm that some media outlets, Time Magazine, others, just historically were willing to take the CIA's call and to do whatever the CIA needed to do?
You know, Ian, I don't know if that's true or not. That's never been part of my research. I focused on the craft, the technology.
Right.
For James Bond fans, it's the world of Q.
Sure.
And my world is how clandestine technology has been used to support agents in the field or accomplish the goals. And that's a bit of a different aspect.
It's the fun aspect of it, for sure.
Well, it's the one that is often most misunderstood. If you ask me, though, as a businessman, do I believe that intelligence has been used very effectively as a front line of defense for the country? I would say absolutely. And do people have obligations to the country? And if that's, helping the country be stronger, and that's providing information, absolutely. I think that's an obligation of a citizen. But that's my opinion.
No, that's totally fair. And the reason I asked, too, is I've been reading a lot about the murder of Mary Meyer, who was the wife of Cord Meyer, former CIA field agent. And what's interesting is her diary was being sought by the CIA pretty openly, as the story goes, because of her ongoing affair with JFK, and how Ben Bradley of the the Washington Post eventually found it and handed it over to the CIA. He thought he should, and I thought, when was the last time an editor of a major newspaper handed over something like that to the CIA? Didn't print it and handed it over to, well, anyway, so I, but that exactly right. Keith Melton's work focuses on the technological aspect of the history of the CIA. And in this case, Lance Burton, master magician, referring to the new book as James Bond meets Harry Houdini. It's the official CIA manual of trickery and deception. What were the surprises in there for you, Keith Melton?
That there was a recognition, and certainly in 1953, that the traditional ways in which we had used deception and that were going to be inadequate. General James Doolittle did a report in the early 1950s for President Eisenhower, and he said that traditional U.S. approaches to intelligence gathering were inadequate, that we were being essentially outspied, and we needed to do anything necessary, regardless of how repugnant, in order to meet the adversaries and confront them and achieve our national purpose. And from that report was a recognition that this World War II model of intelligence gathering was outdated, and that the Soviet Union, especially with detonating the atomic bomb in 49, appeared to have gained on us in every front. In fact, we believed in 1952, 1953, that their brainwashing techniques had developed a new generation of pharmacological spies,
right,
and almost pharmacological robots.
Yeah, super spies, sort of.
And we didn't know. The public believed that, and reporting indicated it. If you remember a movie, The Manchurian Candidate, the Richard Condon novel in 1959, it was that this appeared reality. And because of this, the CIA was charged with developing a response to that.
And the CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception has various techniques in there, written by one of the most famous magicians of the day. And I want to pick that up. And I also want to ask you about a new book that's out that says the CIA has outlived its usefulness and should be dismantled. I'm curious, too, as a historian and somebody who has been associated with it, as you mentioned, it was originally founded to help try to prevent another Pearl Harbor, whether it's time to rethink our intelligence We'll get that coming up with Keith Melton in the next half hour. Also, next hour, Death and Enchantment in a New England Ghost Town. The book is called Dogtown, and it, too, is riveting as it it explores an aspect of our landscape, the cursed landscape of the United States, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Yeah, it was one of those books which many people said we would never truly know the contents of, but it's out and it's reproduced for the holidays. So, you know, perfect gift for just the right person on your list. It's this legendary field manual of trickery and deception that the CIA produced during the Cold War to teach its agents all sorts of things and to counteract what they believed the Russians were already doing, using drugs to create these sort of super spies, these spying robots, these people who could go undercover and were, well, we're all about deception and trickery. So we'll talk about that with Keith Melton. He's got his name on this along with another author, but Keith Melton, of course, is one of the most famous unofficial historians for the CIA in this country, especially when it comes to gadgetry. And so we'll talk about some of the things that we learned that are inside this reprinted manual out for the holidays next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Keith Melton is on with this new recently declassified and reprinted book of the CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception, which was thought to be lost. And if we're talking about the experiments of the Soviets, is this a good time to talk about the real story behind MK Ultra?
Well, it is. MK Ultra was, of course, one of the most secret projects that the country has ever had. Certainly the CIA, and it was massive. But it ran for some 12 years and had 134 sub-projects, and it looked to confirm the reality that were there such things as pills, powders, and potions that you could give to an enemy combatant or someone, and would they start telling the truth? And it developed into a number of different areas. Ultimately, though, many proved successful. Ultimately, it was not a manageable project, and it ended in 1965.
Well, there's some debate about that, though, isn't there, about what year it actually ended? I mean, they, as I understand it, the CIA didn't destroy the documents until the 70s, when the word got out to Congress, and then even after Congress. How was it, the Rockefeller Commission, or what are the commissions in the 70s looking into it? And they, some people alleged even then that the dropping of MK Ultra was just a cover story, that the universities were still doing the research. They're just doing it under a different name.
Well, the program MK Ultra ended in 65. It came to light publicly in the mid 70s when you had the church committees and you had the Rockefeller commissions, and the fact that the public became aware of it, it certainly, there could have been other research in similar areas that continued, but this massive project did end. Very interestingly, it was it proved that some things we thought were real, for example, truth serums. They found that yes, at time you could give people a serum that would make them not lie, but it was often unpredictable, and it worked on some people, not on others. And it, from a practical standpoint, there was just not one magic pill that would make someone that wants to hide things from you all of a sudden tell everything they knew.
Right, but these were some of the early LSD experiments too, right? I mean, Ken Kesey of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was originally part of an MK Ultra university study, wasn't he?
Well, people didn't really understand what LSD was. It had been originally developed in Switzerland as an asthma medicine and remedy.
I didn't know that. Really?
And so in asthma? The early 50s, there was, its hallucinogenic effects weren't really understood, and the early within the CIA, the chemists in then it was called the technical services staff, actually experimented on themselves and documented almost as human guinea pigs to try to understand what was the effect. And indeed, would it, if you gave it to a person, would it make them tell the truth? And it was a period in which they were trying to explore. And of course, in exploration in science, many of the areas you go down aren't successful, but it's the only way you can really perhaps move forward.
The MK Ultra was, I would say, fairly perpetrated on a lot. Many innocent people didn't know they were test studies for MK Ultra.
There were tests done with doctors in academia and in hospitals that, yes, there were some experiments done that were truly wrong, and that's certainly one of the reasons that the program ended.
Right. I thought that was really the key part, that not only that, but that there were many people that were participating as observers for the program that really didn't know what they were supposed to be observing. That, I mean, that there's levels of secrecy that meant that some people got exposed to this for just almost to see what would happen, not because there was an actual sort of observable gain from that. But, you know, I'm also curious about this in this book, this manual of trickery deception. Again, prominent magician gets, you know, sort of gets recruited to help write this and to explain how the agents can best, say, slip somebody something in their drink. Had that been something that was, I mean, that was really kind of breakthrough stuff to help explain how to drop something in a drink and not have everybody know, these sort of sleight of hand things?
If on one hand, the chemist, if there was a magic powder, if you could develop a pill, a powder, a potion that would make an enemy all of a sudden become a spy, well, how could you give them the pill, the powder, and the potion? So the revolutionary manuals were that then the head of the technical service staff, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, reached out to America's most prominent magician, John Mulholland, and had him secretly write the manuals that literally gave page-by-page instructions on how a clandestine officer could use sleight of hand to secretly introduce a pill, a powder, or a potion. And just the concept that ultimately survived it was that the principles of magic used by Lance Burton, David Copperfield, Harry Houdini, have far more applicability to the clandestine world to perpetrate a deception than had ever previously been imagined.
How about poisons? I mean, how about that? What did the manual teach about how, not just knocking out an opponent, but knocking off an opponent?
I remember that the manuals were just merely the introduction of a pill, a powder, a potion. Mulholland had no idea what the pills, powders, and potions were. For him, it was a technique of sleight of hand, because making a dollar bill disappear was similar in a way that you could palm a coin, you could pass a hand over a drink and introduce a pill or a powder. And poisons were certainly developed, and it was a response to what the Soviets were doing. The greatest use of assassination throughout the last century was, of course, by the Soviet Union, who believed that people who were speaking bad of them, be it from Trotsky to Georgi Markov and perhaps even to the assassination a couple of years ago in in London, that the government believed that they could influence and change the world by killing people. The CIA and it certainly looked into exotic poisons and potions, and the legendary eight concepts or ideas on how you would, for example, assassinate Fidel Castro. Ultimately, that wasn't their purpose, and those projects ended. Interestingly, people years later would say, well, why don't we resurrect them and kill Saddam Hussein? But it was an idea at a time which essentially ran counter to the real purpose of the CIA, which is intelligence gathering.
And that I think maybe a good time to get back to this idea. I was entertaining talking to an author who's written a book, former CIA guy himself, and he's written a book about the CIA needs to be completely rethought, that it was originally intended to stop something like another Pearl Harbor from happening. And with 9/11 having happened, that proves that the CIA can't really do what it originally set out to do. And therefore, we need to rethink and to recreate an intelligence agency that's more adapted for today's needs. Where are you with that, Keith Melton?
Well, obviously, intelligence, the ultimate goal of an intelligence service is to protect the country. And the CIA has done a remarkable job. When you look back at 9/11 and in retrospect, when you have billions of bits of data and you're trying to correlate and to track patterns and to understand what is probable for an enemy to do, we certainly need a strong centralized intelligence service. If you look at the 1947 law that created the CIA, it was not simply an intelligence agency. The director of CIA was called the Director of Central Intelligence. And the concept was that the DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, would sit over all of the intelligence services and would coordinate their activity to eliminate duplication of effort and make sure that the country had this integrated approach. Unfortunately, at the time, they created the post, but they never gave the director either monetary control of the other agencies or control of people. So the DCI concept looked good on paper, but it was never enacted. My own opinion would be that when we, following the 9/11 commission, when we established the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, in effect, all we did was create now a new level of bureaucracy, which in effect just did what the original 1947 law had envisioned. Had we only given it the teeth and the power to control people and budgets, we'd have had the same thing.
It's a very interesting idea. So is it possible then that that's just what we need to keep moving in the direction of? Centralize the intelligence, whether it's domestic or foreign, through one office that would coordinate, whether it's, you know, military intelligence from the Pentagon or whether it's electronic intelligence gathered through, satellite or other means, or whether it's field intelligence gathered by actual human beings, that there'd be one person or one office anyway that would see all of it and be able to have an image of the first of the big picture, as opposed to these factionalized departments that sometimes compete with information and therefore don't want to give up the ball. If they've got something really cool, they don't want to tell anybody else about it because that will help score them points later on. That was part of what led to the problem during 9/11.
You keep in mind that intelligence collection within the U.S., looking at counterintelligence, is the purview of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, where intelligence overseas is the CIA. What the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, the concept is that they will indeed do that. The questions we need to wrestle with is that when we are at war, and we are at war now, we need to ensure that intelligence that is collected is shared with individuals within the government that can act responsibly. If we look now back at the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, we'll see where information there was not shared, even in the FBI, because it had been collected in one division.
Right.
There was information from a ruling was sent down from the Justice Department saying that, no, we don't want to share between the domestic side and the intelligence side. We want to stop that. We want to put a Chinese wall there to prevent that information from being shared. And ultimately, that is to our detriment. We cannot afford to do that.
And just as the FBI has offices around the world. They're not entirely focused on domestic. They just they have a different way of sort of defining that. The CIA does, we know, you know, use various means to monitor people that they're interested in, you know, in this country. And we know that. I mean, it's not that's not even debatable, I don't think, that the CIA often goes outside of its mandate to not spy on us. They just do it kind of through backdoor means. And I'm not debating whether that's right or wrong, but I do think that there is a lot of overlap between what the CIA does and the FBI does. And that's why you really we can't just say, well, they, you know, the CIA is outside the door and the FBI is inside the door. Because there's everybody seems to be going in and out of the transom, you know, over the top. So I think that you're right in saying that there should be some sort of central commissioner to look at all of this information. I can't imagine how at this point that could ever happen effectively with all of the you know, with all of the factionalism and regionalism you just spoke about.
Well, the answer is you'd probably eliminate as much bureaucracy as possible. But unless you control people or money in Washington, you have no power. So if you're going to create a post, it has to have the teeth to coordinate the activities. And if you look at the original 47 mandate, had we given that power, we could have perhaps spared this entire level of bureaucracy.
Be nice. The official CIA Manual of Trickery and Deception, co-authored by Keith Melton, and part of a long series of books that Keith has done, always entertaining. Keith, what's the, of all of the deceptions, I mean, we talked about some of the trickery and some of the sleight of hand stuff. What were some of the most interesting deceptions that you saw that were in the book that perhaps even you hadn't actually heard about?
Well, when with my co-author, Bob Wallace, who was the former head of the CIA's Office of Technical Service, which is the real Q from the world of James Bond, was truly an American, this CIA officer. And when we studied it, we found that the great legacy of these manuals was to incorporate the principles of magic in the way that officers conduct their activities. And in the same sense that when a magician deceives an audience, but they have the advantage of controlling the lighting and the timing and the stage, and they can control the sight line of where participants, what they can see of the stage. And it caused a shift in the clandestine world in that officers began to look at a secret operation on the street in the same way that a magician looks at an audience. So the big difference is an audience in a magic show ultimately sees the deception, where in the clandestine world, if the deception is ever recognized, it could, of course, cause a loss of life. And
right.
There's no applause in the clandestine world.
So, that I mean, that explains certainly how they managed the impression that the stage was set. They taught the officers to look at a variety of factors so that the illusion was successful. Was there any one particular illusion that they were teaching officers to try to pull off that was surprising to you?
Well, in the book, we did an introduction and we looked at just all the overlap. A few of the ones that are just astounding to me. One would be a concept called Operation Shaggy Dog. And the idea was, how do you arrange for an agent in a hostile area to actually go into the CIA, into a foreign embassy, perhaps to have a secret meeting? And the idea was, well, let's find a officer that's going to be posted abroad, and let's give him a big Saint Bernard. And the concept, now there's no proof it was ever enacted, but the idea was, what if we could have this big 200-plus-pound Saint Bernard, but at the time we wanted to get one of the agents in for a secret meeting, they could actually don a skin of a dog, put him in a cage, drive him in to the location of the secret meeting, and literally what they do is see the shaggy dog, hear some recorded dog noises, and that would escape the attention of a guard that was just basically thinking it was a run to the veterinarian.
I love that. How about that? Well, There you go. Finally available after all of these years. Yes, it's true. And you can own your own copy of it now for the first time. The official CIA manual of trickery and deception. I like that. The shaggy dog deception. Perfect transition into our next guest, Keith Melton. Always a pleasure. And keep those interesting books coming. Okay.
Thank you. Good night.
Always. Death and Enchantment in a New England Ghost Town. The book is called Dogtown. Alyssa East is the author. She investigated Dogtown, Massachusetts herself. Is it possible that a ground, an area, can be cursed? And if it is cursed, that nothing good can come from it? We'll talk about Dogtown and other cursed towns I've been looking into coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.